Letter to the editor. Sir, I read with much interest your account of the bushrangers that were so successfully captured by the police and stand trial for their lives. I write to add certain particulars regarding the notorious Captain Moonlight, alias Scott. He is an Irishman by birth, the son of a Church of England clergyman, and has led an adventurous life. Scott is, or was, barely 5'7" in height, of a slight wiry frame and quick mobile features. He is hasty and irritable, has a fair education and talks fluently. He was a great favourite with some, though some considered him a scamp and a hypocrite, and others insisted he was mad, and that all the marvellous tales he was perpetually narrating of his adventures were pure invention. Evening News, Sydney, Thursday, 20th of November, 1879.
All right, so welcome once again to Tales from Rat City, the podcast where we explore dark, mysterious and unknown stories of the goldfields of central Victoria.
I'm Tom Hodgson. I write and produce Tales from Rat City.
And I'm David Waldron, and I research, assist in writing, and all sorts of other features.
The third partner in our trio is Katrina Hill, who is a very capable actor, wrangler, and director, and her talents shine through in the quality of the voice actors we get into this program.
Now, we've had a little bit of a delay recently. We've been trying out a new format and a new system, which will create something we hope you enjoy. And we're taking another sort of change of format as well. We're going to be releasing this in three parts. A dramatisation as well as documentary storytelling on the life of Captain Moonlight. And this format, one of the things we're doing is we're very closely working with Bartram Text, as we always do, but we're using some of the records from the period to recreate incidents and have them dramatised through voice actors, sound effects, to create that immersive experience. Now, to some extent, that inherently requires a little bit of liberties taken in terms of our dramatic vision. Yet, on the other hand, we're using verbatim dialogue where possible as recorded by the individuals involved, both in court cases and in police records and other material.
Yeah, in lots of cases, we get overlapping accounts of the same night's events because it all ends up in court. So we have maybe four witnesses to compare on something, which creates a really interesting opportunity to pick out bias. And ultimately, at the end of the day, because as David points out, it's a recreation, we reintroduce our own bias, but at least we get to a lot of sources to play with.
And it's also an interesting question as well with the story of someone like Captain Moonlight. There's a lot of questions over the incidents that he's involved in. Mm. His past is somewhat murky in terms of multiple stories from multiple people. Some of the robberies, including the one we're going to open with here, the great Edgerton bank robbery, are somewhat dubious that we hear it from different people at different times. There's different questions about who people are and what their motivations are. And we hope you, the listener, engaging with this material can start coming up with your own particular thoughts and experiences and theories of the events as they unfold.
Yeah, it's definitely worth keeping in mind that it's one of those cases that, well, first up, it's really important in Captain Moonlight's life. So whatever actually happened on this night is really important to understand all the other things that happened to him. And we don't really know exactly what it is that happened, but you can make your own guess when you hear the material.
But this incident itself kicked off one of the most notable bushrangers in Australia's history. I'd suggest possibly second only to Ned Kelly in terms of fame and perhaps infamy, depending on your point of view. So let's now journey back to 1869 on a cold May night. People would normally be in bed, the street lights are out, and a man suddenly hears a very frantic and urgent knocking at his door.
Mr. Tanner, it's me, Julius Brun. I have been stuck up.
Just a minute.
Ralph, who is it?
It's that lad, the banker from next door. He's been robbed. Go back to the bedroom and wait there. You'd better come inside.
Thank you, Mr. Tanner, thank you. The bank is robbed and it's that man, Scott.
Scott, the priest.
He covered his face up, he blindfolded me, but I know his voice, his walk. As I came to the door tonight, he came up behind me with a pistol and... I must see the police, please. Can you accompany me?
Had you only called out but once, I could have been there.
Scott had it right up against my head.
We heard you come in an hour ago, heard voices. Thought you just had a guest.
He took me up to the bush near the dam and he said he was going to leave me there. Only I have this cold, so I beg him not to. He changes his mind and he takes me back over to the schoolhouse near the mine.
He walked you all about Edgerton.
We never saw anyone. Here. He tied me up with this rope. He had me write a note and he told me to stay in the schoolhouse or his partner would shoot me. Then he fled. He pretends like he's speaking to someone outside, and once I hear him go, I work the rope off and... The police, Mr. Tanner. I'm afraid to ride alone.
Julius, think carefully. Who is it that robbed you?
It was Scott. Andrew Scott. I will swear it was.
So later that night, Constable Monckton joined the bank teller, Julius Brune, to investigate.
Brune, show me what happened here. The door's half open.
Scott and I came in this way.
You never saw his face.
I know Scott well, Constable. I'm sure it was him. His walk, his voice. Here's the note. He bade me turn my face to the wall when he signed it.
I hereby certify that L.W. Brune has done everything in his power to withstand our intrusion and the taking of the money, which was done with firearms. Signed, Captain Moonlight, Sect, Secretary. Well, Mr. Brune, that I've never seen. This fellow can evidently spell well, writing in a clear, steady hand. A real gentleman, your bandit. You said it was dark.
Yes, Constable Monckton.
Then by what light did you and the robber write the note?
Scott also dropped some coins while he was here.
Mr. Brune, how did this robber and you see well enough to write this neat, careful note?
He lit matches.
Excellent. Let's take a look. Ah, a sovereign, 2 half-crowns, and a shilling. No matches. Not the slightest particle of a match.
The matches are right here on the table.
Unlit, Mr. Brune. I was hunting the ones your robber used. Let's meet this Scott.
Constable Monckton and Julius Brune approach Scott in his premises near Edgerton.
Constable Monckton, this is a vile conspiracy.
No, none of these. The one used by the robber had much more silver on it.
I had nothing to do with this outrageous fabrication.
That remains to be determined, Mr. Scott. Do you own any other pistols? Ugh. A lot of pistols for a priest.
And had I used one, you should know about it.
No, no, it is none of these.
Mr. Scott, can you account for your whereabouts this evening?
I have only just returned home from Melbourne.
I'd advise you to speak with your lawyer, Father Scott. Thank you for your time.
Constable.
What did he mean by conspiracy? There is no conspiracy, just me.
It's late, Mr. Brune. I'll see you to your house and continue by light tomorrow. I'll also advise you to speak with a solicitor.
I've done nothing wrong.
The whole affair is most peculiar, Mr. Brune.
Gentlemen, how shall you cast your vote? Believe not the corruption claims cooked up by the illiberal squatterocracy. Only Mr. Jones will stand for working men. Only Mr. Jones supports... Oh, evening again, Mr. Brown. Constable, I'm Harris. Charles Harris. Pleasure to meet you both, gentlemen. Seeking to detain you only a moment to inform you of the great conspiracy afoot in our fair state.
Not the only one.
Mr. Brune, you've been busy tonight, eh? School teachers and coppers.
He is drunk, he's mistaken.
School teacher?
Teachers, constables, miners, Decent citizens all, Mr. Jones will redress your...
You saw Mr. Brune with the schoolteacher clearly? Neither's face covered?
Aye, passing Tanner's, I saw Brune and Simpson walking out from the bank. Why would they cover their faces?
Now that he mentions it, I think it could have been Simpson who stuck me up.
A month later, Julius Brune was brought to trial.
Julius L. Brune and James Simpson have been charged with burglariously entering the premises of the London Chartered Bank at Edgerton and stealing therefrom 164 ounces of gold and about £700 in gold and banknotes, the property of said bank, on the 8th of May. Great interest was manifested in the case, and the Ballarat Circuit Court was thronged. Amongst the crowd watching the proceedings, with much apparent interest, being many influential residents in the town and a few ladies. Their number increased quickly during the afternoon, and not even standing room was obtainable in some parts of the building. The case came before His Honour, Mr. Barry, and a jury.
How do you plead?
Your Honour, Mr. McDermott, for the defence, Julius Brune pleads not guilty to the charge.
Your Honour, Mr. Adamson, representing for the prosecution.
Mr. Adamson, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honour. I shall present the facts of the case. Julius Brune has occupied an important position in the London Chartered Bank at Edgerton, and up until the present time, has been a respected member of our community.
And is still.
I believe I can show the court one of the greatest conspiracies that was ever concocted.
Mr. Adamson first called Constable Monkton as a witness. The constable deposed to all that he had seen that night.
Perhaps most significantly in this case, Mr. Brune has alleged that he was led from the bank blindfolded, accompanied by an armed robber who had a masked or blackened face. I call Charles Harris as witness. Mr. Harris is a miner living in Edgerton. Mr. Harris, please give us your deposition.
Thank you, sir. On the night of Saturday, the 8th of May, about 10 minutes past 10 o'clock, I was standing near Ralph Tanner's fence, near the bank. I had a reflecting lamp lighted in my hand. The night was very dark. I was canvassing for voters for the pending election. I saw two persons coming towards from the direction of the bank. They were walking very quickly. When I first saw them, they were about 100 feet from us. I could see them by the light of the lamp. They came on and I heard the words, "Yes, yes," said by one man. Another voice said something, and the same voice as the first said again, "No, no." As they came close, I held the lamp up and turned the light on. The prisoner Brune was one of the two. I have no doubt Brune is one of the men. Swear positively he was. I believe the prisoner Simpson was the other man. Neither of the two men were disguised that I could see. Brune's hands were down by his side in the ordinary way. The man with Brune had a peculiar gait in his walk. He had a large dark beard under his chin. After they passed, the two men continued their course, and I lost sight of them soon.
Mr. Scott, could you stand, please? Mr. Harris, could this be the man you saw walking with Julius Brune that night?
No, sir. I can swear positively he was not the second man who was with Brune. The peculiarity in Scott's walk and that of the person I saw in the dark are quite distinct.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Scott, you may resume your seat. Your witness, Mr. McDermott.
Mr. Harris, had you been drinking that night?
My mates and I had been at some public houses that night. I had one glass of grog that night up to that time. No more.
Aside from the light of your lantern, could you see clearly that night?
The night was wettish, a Scotch mist, very bad weather. There was no moon. Occasionally the stars could be seen. I had much more important business in hand that night than to look up at the moon and stars. I was looking up the electors of Ballarat West.
Thank you, Mr. Harris.
According to Mr. Brun's own statement, next he was led past Murphy's Hotel. He said he did not seek protection there, as the door was closed. In fact, Mr. Brunn first said there was no light at Murphy's, but he soon changed this statement. Yet in a deposition that I now submit to the court, the tavern owner, Mr. Murphy, states he closed the bar that night at about 11 o'clock. I now call Mr. William Anketell as witness. Mr. Anketell is the acting accountant at the London Chartered Bank of Gordon. The day before and the day after the robbery took place, he visited the Edgerton Bank. Mr. Anketell, please give us your account of those two visits.
I was at Edgerton on the 7th, the day before the robbery, and told Bruin I wanted all the mixed notes to take to Mr. Sutherland, the manager of the Gordon branch. He replied, oh, there's only 20. What's the use of taking so few as that? Leave them till Saturday. I said that I must have them. He then gave them to me. On the Sunday following the robbery, I went to Edgerton and opened the bank door, having previously got the key from Bruin. I found the safe locked and everything in its proper place in the bank, except a few boxes for holding gold and silver coin, which were lying on the floor. I found the whole of the gold and money, amounting to £1,205.13 had been taken out of the safe. The key of the safe was on the same ring as the key of the door. This should not have been the case. He had orders from me to keep the keys separate.
Your witness, Mr. McDermott.
Mr. Anketell, in the normal proceedings of bank business, would it not be unsurprising that Mr. Brunn would wish to keep a mere 20 mixed notes about the bank?
On previous occasions, he always seemed too anxious to get rid of the money, as he did not care for having it in the place.
Thank you, Mr. Anketell.
I shall now refer to the proceedings in the schoolroom. The piece of paper upon which Brunn said that he wrote the statement, at the dictation of the robber, will be an important piece of evidence. In order to have light enough to write this document, Brunn has stated that he had burned 5 or 6 wax matches in the schoolroom. I call Andreas Jensen, minor, as witness. Mr. Jensen is a miner from Ursel Doone Company and was working as watchman on that night. Mr. Jensen, please give us your account of the evening's events.
Thank you. I work at the Ursel Doone claim. We can see the schoolhouse from the claim in daylight or moonlight. On the 8th of May, if there had been a light in the schoolroom, I could have seen it. I saw none. I recollect about 10 o'clock, two men passed and asked what time it was. I could not recognise either of them. They had appeared to be going towards the schoolhouse. They were walking at a moderate pace. Some time after that, perhaps about 20 minutes after 10, Brunn came to me and said he had been stuck up and robbed. He appeared very much excited. He asked me to accompany him up to Tan's. I went with him.
Your witness, Mr. McDermott.
How far were you from the schoolhouse?
The brace of the Ursel Doone shaft is about 400 feet, I think, from the schoolhouse. I was on duty on the brace.
Given the layout of the mine and schoolhouse, should you not have had your back to the schoolhouse most of the time?
I turned around frequently and could have easily seen a light in the schoolhouse if there had been one.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen.
Now I return to the note. This note, dictated by Brunn and signed by the robber, was written on a piece of paper used for listing the attendance of children to the school, and which was placed into the roll book. According to Mr. Brunn's account, he wrote the body of the note, and the robber signed Captain Moonlight, Secretary. That is, S-E-C-T-R. As if he had intended to write secretary, and had not finished the word. I call David James. Mr. James is a lithographic writer and expert in the examination of handwriting. Mr. James, can you describe to the court your analysis?
I have carefully examined the writing of James Simpson in these school books and the document said to have been left by the robber in the schoolhouse. The body of the writing in this document is not the same hand as the signature. I have compared the signature, Captain Moonlight's secretary, with the handwriting in these school books carefully, and my opinion is that Captain Moonlight is a disguised handwriting, and not in the natural hand of the man who wrote it. My opinion is founded upon the fact that the man who wrote Captain Moonlight, when he wrote the letters S-E-C-T-R, forgot to disguise his hand. Those letters are as near approach to a natural handwriting. I've found several similarities between the handwriting in the books and the signature Captain Moonlight Secretary to the document spoken of.
Your witness.
No questions.
So, who is this man that Brun may have attempted to frame? And why the name Captain Moonlight? I shall now call Andrew George Scott. Mr. Scott, please explain to the court your connection to the name Captain Moonlight, Mr. Brun, and of the events on the night of the robbery.
I have trained as a civil engineer in New Zealand. I have been serving as a volunteer there. I held the position of major. I have been called Captain Scott. My comrades used to call me, jocularly, Captain Moonlight. I used to be called so at Edgerton, where I have lived lately and work as a lay preacher. I have known Mr. Broome since the early part of March last. We were, for a time, very intimate. I was introduced to him and he was very friendly to me. On the night of Saturday, the 8th of May, I was visited by Constable Monkton and the prisoner. I told the constable I had come from Melbourne that night. That was not true. I came from Melbourne the previous night. My reason for saying I have come that night was that I had gone to a house near Balan on Friday night to pass the night. I remained at that house all Friday night and all Saturday and left it on Saturday night about 10 o'clock.
Were you alone all this time?
A person accompanied me.
What is his name?
Mick.
His surname?
Is that relevant?
I shall determine what is relevant.
I should think it is not relevant. I would not see him brought into this.
You must answer the question, or risk being found in contempt of court, Mr. Scott.
I do not know any other name than Mick.
Was there anyone else with you during this time?
Another person there was a female. I refused to give her name. The house was a private one, unlicensed, about 12 miles from Edgerton, near Balan. I consider myself bound in honour to refuse giving the name of the woman.
I cannot save you from a charge if I would. I must know the name of the woman.
I must in honour decline to give it.
Mr. Scott, do you understand the consequence of refusing to give testimony to the Crown Prosecutor?
I do, and I am quite prepared for it.
Your Honour, I request you commit this witness for contempt of court.
Mr. Scott, you will be called up for contempt.
My sense of honour prevents me from complying, and I shall leave myself in your hands, Your Honour.
This matter of honour has no standing in the eyes of the law. Remain in court until I have passed sentence on you.
Your witness, Mr. McDermott.
Mr. Scott, earlier this year you appeared as a witness in the court in another matter. In assisting the preparation for that defence, did you meet with the witnesses in advance and direct their testimony?
On one occasion, when a friend of mine was accused of larceny in Bacchus Marsh, I assisted to get evidence of an alibi in his favour. I did not see all the witnesses in the case together and point out to them what the evidence was I wanted them to give. I knew my friend was innocent of the charge, and I knew the value of an alibi.
If you lied to the constable on the night of the robbery, why should we believe you are not lying now?
That statement I made to Constable Monkton, that I had come from Melbourne on the night of the robbery, would have been an alibi in my favour had I been guilty. I regret very much that I did not tell the truth then. But I said what I did to conceal what I had actually been about.
Do you know David James, the lithographer?
Yes, I know a man named James. I have frequently seen and spoken to him since the examination of Broome and Simpson. I have drunk with him occasionally, and have seen the police or two have a glass with him too. I myself have had one or two with some of the police.
Do you normally carry a gun, Mr. Scott?
I have not carried a revolver about me since I came to Australia. I have carried a repeating pistol occasionally.
What is the nature of your income?
I have lived on my private resources for some time past. I was supposed to have received a salary as an unlicensed lay preacher, but I did not.
Were you friends with Mr. Brune at the time of the robbery?
The intimacy that existed between Brune and me was rather abruptly broken off about a month before the robbery.
Thank you, Mr. Scott. That is all.
This was the last of the witnesses for the prosecution. Mr. McDermott now called several witnesses who testified to the character of Mr. Brune as an upstanding and well-respected gentleman who held a significant and trusted role in the community. There was a brief recess, then the defence delivered a closing statement.
It is the wish of my client that no technical objection should be taken, but that this case should be decided upon its broad merits. This prosecution has been shameful and disgraceful to all persons who in any way assisted in it. The case has been presented most unfairly, and with such bitterness as to do no credit to the Crown Prosecutor, who has shown more eagerness for a conviction than I would if my object were to secure a well-merited punishment for a dog. The accused is a young man in a most respectable position, and has risen by his own merits to a responsible position in the bank. The statement of the robbery he made, though no doubt possessed of some verbal imperfections, as all men are prone to from time to time, was true in all essential particulars. And though he was at needs to frequently repeat this statement in the days after the robbery, it presented few discrepancies over time. Strange and peculiar this case might be, but improbable it certainly is not.
At a few minutes before 7 o'clock, the judge finished his charge, and the jury retired. Learning that there was no likelihood of a speedy agreement, His Honour left the courthouse, but most of the crowd lingered about, and when, at 11 o'clock, the judge was sent for, the number of people present was not far short of that in the afternoon. The jury then came in and announced the verdict of not guilty, a deliverance which was received with considerable applause and some slight demonstration of a contrary nature. We believe that 7 of the jury, including all the foreigners, were in favour of the prisoner's acquittal from the time of leaving the court. And, after considerable discussion, it was agreed that the votes of a reasonable majority should bind the remainder. Accordingly, a ballot was taken and resulted in the verdict of not guilty being agreed to. The numbers in the voting being 9 in favour of that deliverance and 3 for the verdict of guilty. Brune showed some emotion after his discharge and during the time he was receiving the congratulations of his friends. The Crown Prosecutor notified intention of proceedings no further with regards to James Simpson, who was accordingly called and released upon surety of £50 to appear when called upon. The age, Melbourne, May 27th, 1869. The Argus, Melbourne, July 24th, 1869, and the age, Melbourne, July 27th, 1869.
Andrew George Scott, the man arrested in Sydney for having been concerned in the Egerton bank robbery 3 years ago, was this morning brought up at the City Police Court and remanded for a week. The prisoner is a smart-looking man, well-dressed and seemingly possessed of much self-confidence and shrewdness. The evidence given to justify the remand was that of Detective Eason, who had brought the accused over from Sydney, from whence he had been remanded for forgery. Eason produced the depositions given there, from which it appeared that the prisoner had sold to the Mint authorities, through the Union Bank, 129 ounces of retorted gold, the sum of £503 being placed to his credit in the bank. The shape in which the gold was sold has not yet been ascertained, as the clerk who purchased it is now resident in Fiji. Portland Guardian, Thursday, 18th of April, 1872.
And so ends the first part of our story. And it's a particularly important one because, in a sense, everything that transpired afterwards in Captain Moonlight's career emerged from the events of that night. Was he a man who was innocent, who became entangled down a rabbit warren of criminal activity leading to criminal activity and ostracization forcing him to live outside the law? Or perhaps was he always a man of dubious character? The quote from his parishioner you heard at the start of this... The quote from the parishioner you heard at the start of this podcast perhaps best illustrates the mystery that surrounded Captain Moonlight and the kind of figure he was to become, and of course in future episodes his relationship with James Nesbitt that has inspired many historians ever since. We hope you've enjoyed our new format this week, and we are looking forward to moving on to the second episode in our Captain Moonlight series, our three-parter special edition, and we hope you enjoyed the experiments we've conducted in new forms of recording and sound effects to help dramatise the event. Thank you so much to our voice actors. We can't make this without you, and your creative ability is so important to what we do. Thanks, of course, to Federation University and Circa for supporting what we do. Thank you for Katrina for your wonderful work in actor wrangling and coaching and directing. And of course, thank you all to our listeners. We can't make this without you, and we hope you enjoy what we do. And of course, a special thank you to our Patreon supporters who give us the resources and funding we need to help produce more episodes for your enjoyment.
And thank you to the Australian researchers who have looked into the story of Captain Moonlight in all of its endless ambiguity, and whose excellent work we stand on the shoulders of to deliver this.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you all, and good night from Tales from Rat City.
No, it's not live radio, but okay.
You've been listening to Tales from Rat City, starring Emil Freund as Andrew George Scott and William Anketell, Dylan Challis as Adamson, the prosecution lawyer, Aidan Brady as McDermott, the defence lawyer, Colin Van Uden as the journalist, Constable Monckton, and the lithographer, Beau Schoemaker as the journalist, Andreas Jensen, and Ralph Tanner, Stephen Tankard as Charles Harris, the judge, and the letter writer, Katrina Hill as Tanner's wife. Tales from Rat City is produced and created by Tom Hodgson, David Waldron, and Katrina Hill.